Marty and Dini come up, and we'll just start with our questions and answers and have a bit of discussion looking at sort of what's driving the value proposition of food.
Hi, my name is Jonathan. I'm a student here at McGill University. I'm just going to preface a little bit of my background so you understand where my question is coming from. This past year, I started a group called the McGill Food Systems Project and went to different levels of government. We got funding, and the basic premise is to have a group of students continuously over the next couple of years focus their applied student research on the operations of the university. To serve as kind of an ever-evolving system of checks and balances to understand, you know, for example, in food, where our food's coming from, who's in charge of our food sourcing decisions, and what we can do as a community to improve those things. We've also developed similar models for operations and construction and stuff, just so that students can get real hands-on knowledge, things that translate to change. So my entire summer focusing on food was working with, because Chartwell's subsidiary of Compass Group runs most of the food services on campus, at least two of the residences, as well as your main competitor, Sodexo, we looked into all of these questions. And to start off, I'd like to say Chartwell's was the most transparent of anyone we worked with, and that was extremely encouraging given the culture that I came from with regard to corporate food service providers on campus. And so that was great, and I learned a lot. However, there are two main things that I think your company is facing right now that haven't been able to be resolved at the local level with the positive incentives that Mr. Don has referred to. And these are the following. We instituted local food days at McGill. So every single residence, each month out of the year, will pick 5 days, and every single meal served for those 5 days each month, even in the winter, so you're talking seasonal menus, totally transforming the way things are working, have to be from Quebec. The biggest problem with working with Compass this semester has been they work with a group, a supplier, so suppliers bring the food to campus, who take financial responsibility or liability for the food to ensure food quality, safety, and stuff. But as a result, they have no idea where the food is coming from. Okay, my biggest concern right now is that we can't. It's really hard to talk about food safety, security, especially given some of the industry issues of, you know, E. coli and the stuff with the meat last year or the year before, if you don't know where your food's coming from. And so one of the challenges is simply that traceability is an afterthought, and it's in situations of crisis and recall, which is good that we know that the capacity is there in retrospect. But what can your company do, and what's been your experience with the whole traceability thing? And where do you see, because I don't think your boss is here, where do you see the potential for real change? Because it's my understanding that you're the largest company in the business, so I think the change got to come primarily from you.
And I'll address the traceability first. Even though it's a large vendor, they do have traceability. I wouldn't say, and there's a lot of quality assurance checks and balances in place there. What I think you'll see in Canada next is a model that we just piloted in the U.S. Over the last year or so, and it's been quite successful. We basically took, realizing that there is a huge demand for local, purchasing locally, particularly produce, and a commitment to supporting the local economies everywhere that we operate. We've put together a model that's been real successful in the U.S., whereby we have the local farmers contract with our produce distributor. So each of the produce distributors, which are regional, bring in 20, 50, 100 local farmers, and it's funneled through that produce house. What that does is the produce house assumes the insurance liability that we have to have in place, and they assume the responsibility for audits for good agricultural practices and things like that. I will say it's been quite successful this year in the U.S. using that model. We did about $15 million worth of local produce across the country and culminated that in September with a buy local month where we did $3 million of local produce just in during the month of September, which was up 60% from the previous year. That's a, again, it was a pilot model in the U.S. We're looking to expand it now because we found that it really does work, and to also expand it beyond produce so that we'll be looking at dairy and meat and other items on a regional basis.
Thank you.
Hal Hamilton, Sustainable Food Lab. And Marty, we work with your sustainable agriculture team a lot. In fact, Young Case Business on co-chairs my board. But I was really intrigued by your description of where, of your sort of corporate, and see, let me see if I get it right, your corporate commitment to nutrition and health among the poorest of the poor at the bottom of the pyramid, so to speak, but how there's not a business case for it. And so therefore, you have to partner with public agencies in order to figure out what to do. And I couldn't quite get how where the transition is from where the business case isn't to where the business case might be.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm the right person to answer. I'm a nutritionist, not an economist. But I think that for certain products, we can make a business case at the bottom of the pyramid. I mean, if you're talking about soap, Unilever brings soap into the market, especially in Asian markets. Lifebuoy is a soap that is affordable for everybody, and we can make a business case for it. But if you know our portfolio, it's a lot of the products that we sell are high added value products. There's a lot of processing, etc. So that's not the type of products, I would say, that people at the bottom of the pyramid would need or can afford. I mean, of course, the ice cream is at the high end, but there's other types of products like the soups and the savory category that you could imagine at the bottom of the pyramids. And, of course, we do have a business which, when we're looking at the single packages of soap, of toothpaste, etc., but when you're looking at foods, nutritious foods with a health benefit, then I have to admit that Unilever doesn't have a portfolio for the bottom of the pyramid apart from the iodized salts that we bring to the market. So looking into what our current portfolio could mean for this group of consumers, how can we transform it, or how can we really get into that market so that they have a benefit and we can grow a business? I think that is a challenge. Yeah.
It just occurred to me, I'll sit down, but that I know that there's an investigation of where smallholders could supply vegetables to be dried for Knorr soup. And I wonder where the loop might be able to be closed with consumers in those places where, I mean, it's all in the planning phase right now, but...
exactly, because...
That might work.
Yeah, no, but then it is, it's on the one hand, you have the supplier side, and on the other hand, you have the consumer side, and I think it's really a challenge to close the loop, and it's something that I'm very passionate about. I'm trying to be involved in as much as possible, but you are facing marketeers that have to make choices on where do I invest my money in a product with a very high profit margin for, let's say, not the the lower D&E groups or for those in the C group, so a little bit higher income. And those choices are still based on... mainly, of course, on business reasoning and not only on social reasoning.
Hi, Kathy Kapka from Ketchum. And I want to raise a question that we all think about and address throughout the day. And we've touched on it a little bit, and it's the whole issue of processing and locally grown, and particularly it's related to produce. We think of fresh as best, But I'm from Chicago. I know we're entering the season just like here, where you're not going to get anything fresh in the produce area. And so I think we need to address the issues of processing, dried, canned, frozen, in these areas, and where and how that is appropriate, and how that we can support that to help feed people.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there's a huge... it's a buzzword to talk about local produce, but there are many areas of the world that it's either too hot or too cold that during much of the year to have a variety of local produce. Some of the things that we have been investigating, I mean, we obviously use a huge amount of frozen produce because we have to. At certain times of the year. But it's interesting because last year the Chicago Public Schools in the U.S. really had a big push for local produce. And we actually took produce that was harvested locally in the summer, took it to a packer and had it frozen. And they've been using that. They used that all last winter. And that seemed to be a very successful model. Will it work everywhere? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that we can contract with enough processors to make that work, but it's a step in the right direction, I think.
I'd like to add one point to that, because I think it is kind of a myth that natural foods are always better than processed foods. Our food technologists, in any case, wouldn't agree with that. And it's not only about fresh and not fresh. I think if I'm looking at dairy, and I'm looking at the different, I mean, Unilever is a margarine producer, and I'm a nutritionist, so I'm looking more at what, you know, butter is natural, but is butter better than margarine? Definitely not. It's animal fats, it's saturated fats, and margarine is vegetable-based, and it's polyunsaturated, and it's not like processed like 20 years ago where you had hydrogenation and a high level of trans fats. So also from a nutrition point of view, it's not true that processed foods are worse or always worse than fresh foods. But this is, again, this is emotional feeling that consumers have. And, of course, we need to take that into account. And we need to use, I mean, fresh vegetables and in our products. I was amazed going to a factory in Unilever in my first year there where they made kind of sauces. I was actually amazed by looking at what went into that. I thought it was much more unnatural than what I saw there. But I basically think that we also, at least as academics, should look very carefully and also educate our consumers that it's not always the case that natural is better than processed, and that's a kind of education process.
Matthew Straub from the Canadian International Development Agency. My point, I guess, or my question follows from what was previously mentioned about how you penetrate new markets through private-public partnerships. And at CETA, that's something we're trying to delve into, how we do that effectively. You mentioned at one point this concept of cost-sharing or risk-sharing with the private sector as you penetrate new markets. And I'm wondering, I'd like to stretch you on that more generally, but my question is, how do you, in the spirit of fairness and equitable development of markets, how do you select, as a government agency, private industries or private companies to go do that type of thing here or there, and not just say, well, Unilever is the most obvious?
I'm not sure I can talk for a public agency, but I think the most important thing is that it's not an exclusivity deal. That is, a government agency or UN agency will never have an exclusive deal with just one company. But I can give you an example of the iodized salt that Unilever brought to market in Ghana a couple of years ago. We actually worked with the Ministry of Health and with UNICEF, helping them to start a public health campaign about the benefits of salt iodization and for consumers to use iodized salt. But there was still a lot of non-iodized salt in the market, and actually there still is. Government had to take care of legislation, of course. Enforcement is another thing, but they took care of legislation. And then they had a huge awareness-raising campaign about the goodness of iodized salt. And that has nothing to do with the brands that Unilever brought to the market. There's other brands in the market. So it was kind of, for me, that's fair level playing field. Unilever did contribute to the financing, but there was nowhere a reference to Unilever. That campaign, and we just did our commercial marketing, but that campaign, actually, I'm not sure if that is all that took it, but in a couple of years, the percentage of households consuming iodized salt went up from 50% to 75%. So there you can see how it works. I must admit that because it's really a small market for Unilever, and because there is still a lot of competition from non-iodized salt or producers that use a process of iodization that brings less quality, actually Unilever is you know, it's not pushing in the market anymore because it's not a viable business for us. But you can make, as you see, from 50 to 75%, you know, if you continue that process working with the government, you actually create a bigger market for everybody, for all the players. And that's, I think, what we need to do. So that's pre-competitive.
David Acheson, currently with Levitt Partners, previously Associate Commissioner at FDA. What do you see, both of you, from the European perspective and the U.S. perspective of the role of regulators in all of this, in terms of regulation per se, in terms of education, and how can, or maybe you could speak to from the European perspective and the U.S. perspective, what your individual experiences have been of interacting with regulators? Has it been positive? Has it been helpful? And how big a role should they or could they play?
From the U.S. perspective, and we do interact quite a bit with regulators, both at the national level and the local municipal levels. I would say that two roles that I see from our perspective, providing incentives.
Trying to get a discussion going, but incentive, how's the government going to provide you an incentive?
I wouldn't say regulation per se.
You mean deregulation?
Not deregulation. Incentives, I'll come back to that. But the other thing is education, consumer education, partly because companies can make a lot of changes, but we need consumer demand to fuel that. And I'm not talking about sitting around and waiting for consumer demand for healthier foods. I'm talking about when you launch lines of healthier foods, it's only so long you can keep them in the marketplace if there's not demand. So education, help with driving demand through the educational process. That, I think, is key because that will fuel more innovation in and of itself. And I think that is probably the biggest incentive for companies, as we heard earlier in the keynote today. The more incentive, the more pats on the back, if you will, that industry has for taking small steps, the more inclined they are to continue to down that path.
I would say that I think the role of regulations are very important. But if regulation is too strict and it's not possible for companies to distinguish themselves from other companies because there's just one big black hole, what is not possible. You know, if you can't make certain claims, although you can prove the claims are right, but nobody can make any claims, then I would say the good products cannot distinguish themselves for the less good products. And that, I think, there is a line to walk. So too much restriction is really detrimental, is really discouraging companies to bring good foods to the market, which abides to all the regulations. But if you can still allow, because the claims that people can make, that is important, of course. That's what the marketeers are looking for. When can we make a claim and when can't we make a claim? Because a claim can distinguish you from your competitor. And I think that there is a line we really have to look for. If anybody can make the same claim as in the case of the iodized salt, because there's no enforcement, then is not useful. Or if nobody can make a claim, then nobody will make the extra effort to really add some more fortificants or other nutrients.
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
I'm sure you're aware of the recent problems in the United States around health claims in certain cereals. And that's obviously given the whole health claim a significant black eye in the U.S. in terms of consumer perception of, mm-hmm. of health claims. And I think it's thrown the gauntlet down to the regulators as how do they regulate that? Mm-hmm. What is the bar? And I take your point about incentives. There needs to be an incentive. And I think part of the challenge I'd put to Janet and her team is looking at how do you better build these partnerships that you both talked about, between the private and the public sector, identifying those incentives but doing it in a way that does cross-cut because it can't be seen as Unilever-centric or Compass-centric. That's not going to work because the feds won't go there. But that's a sort of just a comment. And I think my sense is that both of you are challenged with how do you work with the regulators. Mm-hmm. Having been a regulator for 8 years, it from the other perspective of how do you work with industry? And I'd say that's something that you guys could seriously help with. Anyway, thank you.